Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode 110, featuring the return of Vlado. Vlado has been on a few times, and those of you who are tuning into the podcast and don't know who Vlado is, well, he's kind of my boss. He's also the guy who, one of the guys who invented V-Ray, and he is a very, very, very smart person, and he happened to be in town because he was receiving an Academy Award, a Scientific and Technical Achievement Award for V-Ray, which is what he wrote, and its contribution to the film industry. So, great to have him in town. I figured might as well have him sit down with us, talk to us about what he thought about going to the SciTech Awards and receiving that. And also, since he was in town, we had recently released V-Ray 3.5, and it would be a good opportunity for us to talk about it. So V-Ray 3.5 for 3D Studio Max, or 3DS Max, sorry, I'm still old school. I still say 3D Studio. Anyway, it's been out for a couple weeks, and there's a lot of new features. And those of you who haven't tried it, we're breaking down all of those features for you guys so you can hear it straight from Vlado, which is really cool. On top of that, we also talk about the upcoming V-Ray for Nuke 3.5, which is going to be released very, very soon. So you'll hear all about those features. And if you're interested in that, you should go check that out. It's always good to have Vlado in town because he just kind of tells it like it is. Love having him around because he's just a really good guy. Don't really have any other big announcements to talk about internally, but I just want to sort of do a little plug for something that I went to. Mark Allen was one of the guys who I work with. He was telling me about an exhibit, and I went to get in touch with their PR people and see if about checking it out. And they were really kind to get me a media pass because of the podcast to go check out this Science Behind Pixar exhibit, which is over at the California Science Center here in Los Angeles. So if you happen to be in the Los Angeles area or you live in Los Angeles and you have kids, that's one thing, or you don't have kids, but if you have kids, it's super great. Take them to the California Science Center and go check out the Pixar exhibit, the Science Behind Pixar. It's really cool. They talk every process of the animation, lighting, animation, modeling, simulation, rendering, all of it is sort of broken down into discrete interactive exhibits, and it is super, super well done. Every part of it is interactive. Cameras, layout, everything. Really, really impressed with it. It got my kids to understand what was going on, and they were just super excited about it. They just couldn't get over it. So highly recommend go seeing it. I'm going to really, really try to see if I can get some of the people who were involved in the exhibit at Pixar to be on the podcast. So hopefully we can make that happen as well. The only other thing I'd say, and if you go, Vlado and I will discuss a lot of stuff on this podcast. So I go back to the podcast, a lot of things. And so go check out the show links for any reference that you may need that we're talking about. So we talk a lot about VR things, and there's links that you're going to want to look up in there. All right, guys, hopefully you will enjoy this podcast with Vlado.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Please, Comas. Do you ever watch Silicon Valley, Vlado?
Which one?
Silicon Valley?
Nope. I tried to, but I just got barely through the first episode and I gave up.
It gets super, it's super funny.
So everybody says that.
There's a guy who is a billionaire, right? He made his $1 billion.
Yep.
In Silicon Valley, and he's obsessed with the fact that he's a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes his own brand of tequila, which he calls Tres Comas, for three commas for the amount of zeros.
Yep. All right.
And he has a painting in his house, which is just three commas on it.
Yeah.
It's good.
There's a great part where he's getting out of his car And he opens up, it's a regular car door.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know what's wrong with this? He's like, billionaires don't have cars, the doors that close like this. They close like this, and he raises his hand. Or like this.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, because he lost a bunch of money, but it was funny. All right, Vlado, let's first talk about your weekend. How was your weekend?
The weekend was great.
Yeah?
Actually. The SciTech Awards were on Saturday, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's what took most of the day on Saturday, getting ready for the actual event.
Yeah.
And then the award ceremony in the evening.
Yeah.
Sunday was all about relaxing.
Yeah, imagine.
But so how was it? You've never been to an event like this before, right?
No, obviously. I've never worn a tux in my life.
Right. That was fun.
It was the first. It was fun. It was actually way more comfortable than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Except for the shirt, which was too tight.
Yeah, collared shirts when you have to wear a tie kind of sucks.
But everything else just was okay.
Yeah.
I think you should just get a tux and wear it around at the office. Like,
you look good in a tux, man. I mean, it was very James Bond look to you. It was good.
I still sort of secretly wish that you guys would have dressed up like Harry and Lloyd from Dumb and Dumber and like a yellow and powder blue tux. Like, hi, guys.
Yeah.
No, you guys look very, very good, very classy, very, very cool. Yeah. So we saw the video, obviously, came out. I guess it was the official video of your winning the thing.
I hope so, because I shared it on social.
It was funny that it got shared before it went public. So I don't know how that happened.
It was definitely, it was unlisted, I guess, or something, because I saw it and it was great. You did a fantastic talk about it, thanking the right people. But there was something at the beginning that he says, like, I was hoping I wasn't going to. So were you one of the first people to get the award or something?
I was the third, actually. Okay. But still, it was just I was trying to just get into the mood of it. Yeah. So being one of the first people is obviously the worst.
Yeah, well, it was really cool. It was really cool. It was nice to see pictures of you and Marcos as well there.
Yep.
And so for those of you who don't know, Marcos is the guy who created Arnold. So he is the A in Arnold, although it's an M. But Marcos is a really nice guy. I've known him for a while too, and he's very obsessed with rendering just as much as Vlado. He has a different philosophies about it, but they're also very valid.
Another one of the tall VFX guys.
He's tall. Like,
tall guys.
He's a tall guy. Yeah. But it was cool that you guys both got nominated for it, which would be, for those of you listening, you can go back to the Darren Grant episode, because this was really, on that day, was a lot of it was kind of happening in terms of that news, because Darren Grant came by to do his podcast and he was encouraging us to submit for the SciTech Awards, which we were going to do anyway. But just hearing the information about how this whole process goes through, how it getting vetted, because it's tough. It's not like, hey, I made a movie and maybe I'll get nominated. It's you have to make a case for yourself, presenting a paper and everything.
And go back in time, right? You've got to go back in and figure out, like, when did this happen? And
We have the list of movies that Vera has been used on. Like, we've been collecting this through the years just in case it would come in handy.
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah.
Which is cool. But there was also, there's an in-depth interview. There's a presentation where we have to talk about Vera in general. And then the committee does a lot of additional research, talking to people, developers, users, trying to figure out which of the submissions deserve an award. So it's a long and complicated process.
Yeah, because what happens is someone presents something as like, here, this is something that should be recognized by the scientific technical achievement. And sometimes there's several people that make a product that's similar, which was the case in our thing. So Arnold was one of them. V-Ray was another one. And another one that I think was really interesting is the guys from Blue Sky.
Yep,
because
they also got an award.
And they got an award as well, right? And I remember that moment. I think that was the moment where I was like, oh, global illumination, right? Because they did it before most anyone did in terms of some kind of a production animation.
Was it the first Ice Age or the?
No, it was Bunny.
Bunny.
Oh. Do you remember Bunny, the short?
I haven't seen
it. Oh, yeah.
Oh, for some reason, I thought it was...
Yeah, and it was... And then they used it in feature films, obviously, after that. But it was the first sort of proof of concept. And those guys are pretty cool. I was really, really interested in that. And that's when, from, you know, for you and I, from an architect point of view, we know the importance of global illumination. Yeah. Right? And
Thank you, Vlado. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. If it was, yeah. Because we were at the age where we're like, we're still suffering through Lightscape.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Radiance.
Mm. Yeah. And your geometry had to be perfect.
Like, no, if you cracks. Had a, if you had a table and you wanted light to bounce around it, you actually had to cut out the polygons around the table legs to meld them with the floor.
Yep.
What?
Yeah. Everything had to be the most arduous, you know, modeling just to make sure that GI would look correct.
And you spent all your time painting out artifacts because there was always these like weird gradients and...
Yeah,
that was terrible.
So when ray tracing became like, we can just do it all with ray tracing. I was like, oh, really? Yeah, it was a big deal. And I think that obviously it was really nice to see that. And V-Ray has been used. How many movies did we? We said over 150.
Over 150. We actually think the number might probably be much bigger, but there's a bunch we have to confirm.
160, but these are only movies that we know about, and there are others that we don't. Right. And the number of movies came out afterwards.
So. Yeah. And there were also, you know, basically we looked at only, I think, the top 100 films of each year, too, because there are a lot of films, you know, there's like a bunch of German films and, you know, foreign language films that we didn't kind of add to the mix.
Sure. Well, let me ask you a question, Vlado. Lon and I have been saying that the architecture world was one of the ones that sort of pushed global illumination in V-Ray quite a bit.
Yep.
And so what role do you think the architecture field has in terms of the success of V-Ray and ultimately being recognized by the film industry as well?
Well, it's always been a little bit of both, right? Because we did from the beginning things that architects wouldn't need right away, like motion blur, hair, and so on. Well, hair was a little bit later, but so in any case, we haven't really made V-Ray specifically for architecture, specifically for EFX. We just wanted to cover
all the bases,
all the possible use cases. But architects picked it up a little bit more readily because I guess originally we had only a 3ds Max plane, so it was kind of normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because we saw the scene complexity grow very quickly as soon as people realized that they can render stuff now.
Right.
And so GI was one thing, but then people started adding more geometry. They wanted to be able to create more complicated shaders with layering, more realistic lighting. So it's... We did a lot of things for the architecture guys, but they're all things that eventually ended up being used for everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the things I remember specifically that really kind of helped in terms of global illumination was image-based lighting, right? So image-based lighting became, in the older days of V-Ray, the only way to get an environment light, like a HDR light, to influence the scene was through some kind of a GI solution.
Yeah, initially, the only way to get environment lighting was to just use an environment map.
Right.
Which obviously didn't work well at all with HDR textures.
Right.
So we added the V-Ray dome light at some point. I think it might have been in 2004.
Yes.
And actually, V-Ray was one of the first renderers to use multiple important sampling for the dome light, where we could calculate the light contribution both with direct illumination and GI.
Right.
And it worked really well. So later on, we did it for all the other light sources as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people still consider, you know, environment lighting as a GI solution. But it's not. You can use it as direct light in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but the trend lately is for the renderer to do this internally. Like even if you put an environment map, the renderer would create a Dome White internally. Okay. We haven't done this yet in V-Ray, but it's definitely something that we will do in one of the next versions so that you wouldn't even think about it. You would just put a map in the environment and the renderer will do whatever it has to do to render it.
Yeah, and that's basically a workflow thing, right? Make it take out a couple of steps.
Well, there are some advantages to having a separate light source if you want to do like lighting exclusion and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, for many users, having a simpler workflow will help.
This is good. This is going to be a good transition because we're going to talk about 3.5, but I want to talk about the legacy of V-Ray, like those types of workflows, and how it's hard for some people to transition towards 3.5 in some ways because they have a lot of preconceptions.
Forget what you know.
Forget what you know, right?
Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge for us because we have people that have used V-Ray for more than 10 years and they are used to working a certain way because that's what they know.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that things are changing, and if people want to stay competitive, they should really learn the new tools, right?
Right.
And all the new things that we have in V-Ray, just sticking to irradiance caching and stuff like that is just not feasible anymore if you want the quality of your work to match what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is some people say, oh, this renderer is, like they'll look at another renderer, it's like, oh, this renderer is better. And it's like, well, if you used V-Ray like it was a new renderer that you've never used, and you'd probably have much better results. And you gave a video that I now use as my new Bible. I mean, I'll be honest. I was one of those guys that stuck with the universal settings, quote unquote, for a long time, longer than I should have. But you put out a video, maybe it was about a year ago, where you're basically saying, when someone comes up to me with a scene that's problematic or too slow or whatever, first thing is I do is I wipe out.
You turn everything off.
All the settings. He goes to this thing where basically he's in max, right? So you actually open their scene and you change render to scanline and then change it back to V-Ray, and it basically resets all of V-Ray to its default settings. And just doing that can substantially increase the quality and decrease the render time.
Yeah, I actually noticed the same thing recently when I did comparisons of V-Ray 1.5 and V-Ray 3.5. And I took these scenes which were done like several years ago. And even like when you open the scene in the new V-Ray version, it renders faster, obviously, and that's nice. But if you reset all the settings in the same way that you just said, it first it renders faster and second it renders a lot cleaner as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good approach to say, you know, I'd encourage people just to think about that. Think about the fact that you may have been using legacy settings for a long, long time.
Well, I mean, the reality is it's very different under the hood now, right? I mean, all the smarter algorithms, all the...
Yeah, this is only possible because we worked very hard to make V-Ray faster, and we added things like adaptive light, smarter sampling, so people really don't have to worry about a lot of stuff that before they had to manually figure out for every single scene.
Right. Brute force isn't as scary as it used to be.
No.
You shouldn't be afraid to just use brute force.
For a lot of the scenes that I tried, just using brute force is actually faster than using the irradiance map.
Right. You still use light cache, though.
Well, yes. The light cache is still...
It's a great solution for lots and lots of bounces.
Yeah, and it also allows us to use additional optimization things like the adaptive lights.
Mm-hmm.
Because just being able to look at the scene before we start rendering it allows us to figure out things that we wouldn't be able otherwise.
Well, let's talk about that. So let's go right into some of the features about 3.5 that are kind of big. Obviously, we announced it last week when we're recording this, but it'll be a couple of weeks when this comes out. But adaptive lights, it's kind of a big deal.
Yes.
It's a real big deal. So tell people a little bit about it. So you mentioned the process of using the light cache, but what's smart about it?
Let's start with a little history. So the adaptive lights as an algorithm, it was originally our GPU guys came up with it. Because they wanted to improve the way we render light sources in V-Ray GPU. And Blago had this idea where we should try to make it smart where Viri would do a few passes through the scene, figure out which light sources are important and which are not. And by important, I mean which light sources contribute to which part of the image. And then reuse this information later on to speed up the rendering. And they did a few different tests to figure out a good way to make it work. Initially, it didn't seem to work too well, but that was before I got my hands on it. And then I took their ideas and I did a few tests with the CPU version of V-Ray, and eventually we figured out a way to make things work in sufficiently general and stable way. Mm-hmm. So now that's the default option in V-Ray. And we've noticed from a test that I did, because I did a lot of tests where I took an existing scene and I rendered it with a bunch of different settings to see how it works, whether there would be any artifacts. And overall, the general speed up was about 50%. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it could go lower or higher. For some extreme cases, we've had like 7 times faster renders. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen for every scene, but for many scenes, the average speed up is about twice, which is great. And I didn't actually expect them to have such an effect. And for the GPU render specifically, the speed up is even greater in many cases.
Right. But I think what's interesting is that it's like a smarter evolution of the probabilistic lights, right, in a sense.
Yeah, initially we had this probabilistic option where V-Ray, when you have a scene with lots of light sources, V-Ray would try not to evaluate all of them at every shaded point. Mm-hmm. And we had different versions of this. But the truth is that because the renderer can only sort of guess which light sources would be important for a given shading point, it can make some decisions, but it doesn't take into account everything. Like a light source may be very close to some surface, but it may be blocked by something that casts a shadow. And the renderer doesn't know this in advance. The adaptive lights allow us to collect this information and make the whole process a lot more efficient.
Right. And the key is that every ray only takes into account a certain number of lights, not all the lights.
Yes.
So the more lights you have in your scene, the better advantage adaptive lights has, right?
Right.
And so you could have, and because it's like, I'm only going to base each shading point based on 16. I think the default is 16 lights.
The default is 8 lights.
8 lights. So I'm only going to evaluate 8 lights at a time, and I'll pick the most important 8 lights based on what I'm looking at.
Yep.
You can have scenes, and I've seen Lele was doing like scenes with 10,000 lights or something.
Yeah, I did a scene. Well, the biggest one that he ever got to was 20,000 light sources.
Right. Which would be a nightmare to ray trace.
Just wouldn't rain.
That's the thing, right? It's to the point of, not only does it make it faster, but in certain cases, it's the only thing that makes it work.
And what's interesting also that I think is like, if you have a scene, a similar scene, and you have a thing with, you have 4 lights or you have 20,000 lights, the difference in rendering time is almost the same.
Yep.
Because it's smart about it. The amount of lights is no longer an issue.
Yeah. And the cool thing that we can use the same approach to also speed up things like the dome light. We haven't done it yet, but it's on the roadmap for the next version, where we can split the dome light into smaller light sources and figure out which are more important for a given part of the scene.
Yeah.
So, and that's something that's coming, and it hopefully will help a lot of
image-based
lighting as well.
Multiple important sampling.
It's kind of like
super super important sampling.
Super important.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that the GPU guys were some of the guys who first sort of tackling this. The GPU guys have actually been doing a bunch of stuff in 3.5.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, they did an awesome amount of work for this release, and not all of this is obvious. The adaptive lights and the general speed up are obviously there, but they also work to reduce the memory usage. We worked on getting more shaders to work. They actually took a bunch of scenes that rendered differently on the GPU compared to the CPU render. They figured out why, and they fixed a lot of discrepancies. Mm-hmm. So, and it was funny because at some point we decided to test different scenes that we had and separate the ones that rendered on the GPU and the ones that didn't come out exactly right. But it turned out that almost everything came out right.
That's great. Yeah. There's a few things. Also, one thing that was important to me, obviously, is what was done with the MIT mapping. And this is kind of a big deal because if anyone's been using GPU rendering, which I think a lot of more people should definitely be using it, one of the biggest issues is the amount of memory that you have on a card, right? And a lot of people have video cards that are very powerful, and not the ones that are not as expensive have less memory. That's the biggest cost of GPUs now.
Yep.
So if you're lucky enough to have a 24 gig M6000, you can fit a lot of stuff on there. But one of the biggest problems, one of the biggest memory hogs on GPU rendering has always been texture maps, almost more than geometry.
Oh, way more than geometry.
Yeah. You can, geometry-wise, you can fit a lot in just a few gigabytes, but textures were always a problem. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing that we looked into. And there were a number of things that we did. MIP mapping is just one of them, but even without that, we reduced the memory usage for textures.
Yeah, almost like if you turn off the MIP mapping, it's still like 50% less memory, right?
Yep.
So that's really cool. But let's talk about MIP mapping, because let's assume that not everyone knows what MIP mapping, or they know what it is, but what is it specifically, and how does V-Ray do it? Because most of it's under the hood. The users don't even have to worry about it.
Well, the way the MIP maps work in a normal renderer is, originally they were designed to help with anti-aliasing.
Yeah.
Because as an object gets away from the camera, if you have detailed textures, they would start to shimmer and basically creates a problem for animations.
Right.
And that's why people initially invented MIP mapping. But it's also a great memory saving technique because it means that you don't have to load the full resolution texture if the object is far away from the camera.
Right. So a MIP map, for example, let's just say a MIP map is of a 4K texture. If that texture is only occupying about, 100 pixels on the screen, you don't want to load all 4,000 pixels, right? So a MIP map actually stores multiple resolutions of the same texture within itself.
Yep.
So as a 4K, a 2K, a 1K, a 512, 256 is down, right? So.
Yep. And the normal CPU version of V-Ray can build those MIP map levels on the fly, and it uses the one that's appropriate for a given shading point. By the way, the GPU guys is actually a little bit smarter because initially when you start rendering the scene on the GPU, V-Ray will keep track of which textures are used and at what MIP mapping level, and it will load these textures on demand. And then after a while, when we figure out that all the needed textures are already loaded, we switch to a faster version of the GPU code that just uses what's already loaded on the GPU, and it continues to render the image at full speed. So there's, again, this warm-up phase, the first few passes, where V-Ray tries to figure out the level of detail for the different textures.
Right.
And then it goes full speed.
So it's machine learning built in. It's learning what it needs, and then it...
Yeah, it's like the adaptive lights. Like, you learn about the scene, and then you use this information to render faster.
I asked about it the other day, actually, because I was sitting here mucking around with a scene file, and I said, hey, I'm looking at the log as V-Ray is going and on the GPU rendering, and it said switching algorithms or something after six passes, and it basically goes like, let me learn a bit of the scene. It's like, all right, I got everything I need to go, like as full speed ahead.
Yep, it's very impressive.
Yeah, it's very impressive. So I'm excited about it. So that's a big one. The other one, obviously, there's always been a little bit of an issue with bump maps, and we came up with a new way to sort of load any procedural bump map of some kind.
It's not actually a new way. It's more like the V-Ray core has had two ways to do bump mapping for a long time, traditionally. Mm-hmm. We used one of these approaches in 3ds Max, and the other one was used in Maya.
Okay.
The version that we had in 3ds Max requires each texture to provide special code to compute bump mapping for this texture. Mm-hmm. Whereas the version that's in Maya just samples the texture at the few different points, usually three or four, and then there is the bump mapping based on that. And the version in Maya can work with any kind of texture because it only needs the texture to compute a color. It doesn't require special bump mapping code from the texture.
Okay.
And we've had this version in the GPU code for a long time, so things worked fine in Maya. In 3ds Max, we didn't have this, but what we did instead was to make the V-Ray color to bump texture to work, and it allows people to wire any supported procedural textures and compute bump mapping from just from the color of the textures, and it works fine on the GPU.
So it's like an intermediary node. It's like now just interpret it as anything. Yep. So anything works that way.
Yes. It's generally a little bit of a problem with our GPU support because we basically try to support all the native features of the application that we are rendering in. And because obviously when people use a GPU in Max, they want to see the same result as what they expect from the Max shaders. And in Maya, obviously they expect the result from the Maya shaders. And it makes our GPU code a lot more complicated.
Right.
Compared to other renderers that just say, well, this is how we do bump mapping and we don't care how Max does it or how Maya does it.
Right.
And but we've tried to make it as convenient for the users as possible, but it's also a problem for us.
Right. Yeah, because you have to support a lot more.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of sucks. But we do have this system now, which is pretty cool, and we saw some great results. I think Thomas from Debarty showed some really cool examples of the bump mapping thing.
Yep. Yeah, really cool with stuff with the planet. And
yeah. Yep, it was really great, and it's kind of nice to see that. What are some of the other big GPU things that we saw? Obviously, they're supporting a lot more features like clipping planes and...
We added support for the V-Ray Clipper, support for the aerial perspective.
Oh, that's right, aerial perspective. And it's pretty nice. So we wrote a blog post about it. Go check it out on labs.chaosgroup.com.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in general, one of the messages, you know, like word we're trying to get out is that GPU rendering, go out there, try it now. We're sort of kind of deprecating the RT name, right? Because people associate that with this idea that GPU is sort of a preview render.
Yeah.
That's not really true anymore. So we're kind of moving towards...
It's a full-on production render.
V-Ray GPU, V-Ray CPU, they're both full-on production renders.
Right.
And they match about 99%, between the two and switching.
Right.
There's a few things that can only happen in the GPU.
But I kind of like the fact that, you know, like, hey, you want to work, let's say you want to work at your desk and you need to get through iterations fast, you can go to a GPU, but your farm is not necessarily full of GPUs and you want to switch to CPU and then you can get pretty close back and forth to that. So it'll actually help you in your process a lot. So I think I still think that's a great advantage of the fact that we work on both systems.
Although if you want to use GPUs eventually for final work, you should generally keep this in mind from the start. Like if you try mid-project to switch from CPU to GPU, it's probably not going to work.
Right. But if you start with GPU...
If you start with GPU, then it's a lot easier. And we have a lot of users that follow this approach and it works great.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, I want to talk about a couple other big 3.5 things. One of them is resumable rendering, which is kind of awesome as well.
Yeah, we spent quite a bit of time on that.
Right. So here's just scenario, right? You are rendering and let's say it's taking too long, but you need to do something else, but you still need that render. Instead of you waiting for that render to finish, you can stop that render and resume it later when you have time, like when you're going to lunch or something, right? Because you don't want to sit, it's 10 o'clock and you started rendering. It's like, oh God, it's going to take an hour. I need to do other things. You can still stop it and then resume it while you're at lunch or something. Or your computer crashes. It happens sometimes.
Right. You get a blue screen.
That's one of the use cases. But actually what we notice is that most of our users, while this approach is possible, actually it's way more useful when you do animations.
Right.
Because then you can set a time limit for each frame. And just to get a preview, like you can let each frame run for 2 to 5 minutes.
Right. So this is an important part because we actually support resumable rendering in two different ways. We support it in bucket mode where it'll just resume from whatever the last bucket was, which makes sense. But we also, and this is the big deal, we set it for progressive rendering, right?
Yep.
So it sets a cache or some kind of thing on disk that says, here's the state I'm in. You can continue to go from that point forward. And that's kind of a big difference, right?
Yep, yep.
So in the scenario you explained is someone, you can get basically a noisy version of all your frames in a few minutes.
Yep, yep.
And then it'll continue to get better as you go.
Yeah, and then you can run the animation for two more, five more minutes per frame until you get it right. And that's actually way more useful for our clients.
Right. And they can just basically, you know, using Deadline or whatever, they can easily set up a script to do that scenario. It's like, just keep going, you know, give me a version of the animation every 2 minutes and then just keep going and keep going and keep going. Which is kind of cool. I remember something ideal-wise that was done similar in what was the name of that render? Wortley's, it was a light.
F-Prime?
F-Prime, yeah. Wow. I have no, I don't know. Is F-Prime still around?
I have no idea.
Yeah. But they did, they had an idea like that a while ago.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a cool, and I was like, we have to get this in Vira. So now we do, and I think it's a really good solution. A lot of people are embracing it. They're writing their own, changing their render farms to support it. So it's a kind of a great thing. Okay, let me see what else. Live VR rendering.
Oh yeah, that was an experiment that we actually looked at live VR rendering in the summer of 2015.
Okay.
But then it was working, but you can't get 90 frames per second out of any render with ray tracing right now. So we realized that it's not really an option right now. And then the developer who's working on this had the idea to basically lock down the camera and just render a spherical panorama, allow the user to look anywhere they want it.
Right.
And show the image as it updates and as the quality refines. And we tried it and it worked really well, actually, especially with GPU rendering. And we also had a problem where our clients who were doing VR stuff had to go through a very long process just to be able to test their images. Like you set up your camera, you render your scene, and because you render a cubic panorama, usually it's a large resolution, takes a while. You render it out, then you have to load it up in a viewer, and sometimes conversions are needed along the way.
Yeah.
Before you can actually see whether you put the camera in the right place, for example.
Yeah.
And it's very inconvenient. So that's why they wanted a way to very quickly see what's going on and how the scene will look in an actual VR headset before they press this final render button.
Well, you and I were visiting a studio just last week, and they were talking about exactly that problem, right? Because they do a lot of VR there, and they do a lot of cube maps and environment, spherical panoramics, stereo spherical panoramics. And everyone has a headset at their desk, everyone. So they're all rendering, and it's like, oh, I got to do this, and then I got to convert it to that, then I got to put it on the display. This is like, no, just render. And then you select a output to VR in V-Ray, right? And we support two of them, right?
We support the Oculus headset and the Vive.
Right. And we do it through OpenVR for the Vive, right?
Yep.
So if you have a headset, basically it opens another frame buffer that just links back to your headset. And you can look around and you will see a progressively refining image. But the looking around process is 90 frames a second, right?
Yeah, yeah, obviously, because it just shows you a static image.
I recommend, though, because I tried it, and you were telling me be very careful. You really, if you're going to use GPU rendering, which I would recommend you do as well, you should really have two GPUs.
Yeah, definitely.
Have two cards.
Yeah. One is for display, because if you're rendering on the one that is displaying to your Oculus, it's going to be bogged down with the rendering, and that performance will be...
Yeah, you're not going to get 90 frames a second.
Yeah, and it'll make you sick pretty quick. Yeah.
the other cool thing with it is if you're using an Oculus Rift, you can actually get the controller, the Xbox controller. You can write and bind Mac script functions to all the different keys.
Oh, really?
So you can script sort of very simple scene manipulation stuff. Like you can script, you can make a script to move your camera back and forth or change the lighting or change materials.
Oh, right.
And
nice.
It's useful if you want to very quickly see different, but because if you have the headset on, if you have the Oculus on your eyes, it's very difficult. Like if you want to do something in your scene, you have to take it off and do the change and put it back on.
Or like peek through the nose hole.
It quickly becomes very boring. And this allows you very quickly to script something and be able to change things in your scene.
I like the idea of binding the camera position on the joystick.
Yeah,
right?
Basically move around so you could set up your view exactly where you want
it. There's a sample script in our documentation that explains how to set that up. Unfortunately, it only works for the Oculus right now and the Xbox controller, but it's still cool.
Yeah.
And then setting the light, whether you're going to control sun position or you control even the rotation of the HDR, makes a huge difference when you're just in it looking at it.
Well, there are two joysticks on the on the Xbox controller, one for light and one for camera, would be great. Well, that's cool. Yeah, I haven't actually tried that yet, but I have tried the live VR stuff and it's pretty awesome. And I think that since a lot of our customers are doing a lot more content in VR and doing a lot of QMaps, and we know it's very popular now, that would be really useful for them to have. Okay, what are some of the other big things? Ale surface shader. That's something.
Right. Yeah. That was an interesting one. So as things usually start, this one also started with a user that was asking about more realistic skin shading in V-Ray.
Yeah.
We've had the V-Ray SS2 shader for a long time now, and it works great usually. But the Ale surface shader is just a little bit more advanced. And it also has two coat layers, which is more convenient if you do things like skin, because then you can have like a normal specular layer for the skin. But then if you want to make the skin wet or something, then you have another layer that you can use for that. And you have different, you can apply different bump maps to each layer. It's just a little bit more advanced.
Right.
It also has a more realistic subsurface scattering model. It uses a directional diffusion calculation, which looks supposed to look more realistic, I guess.
Right.
And I was very lucky that Anders Langlands actually open sourced his shaders.
Right.
So I just looked at the code and I reworked it, rewrote it basically to work with V-Ray. And it turned out that I can get it to produce exactly the same result as the original Ale surface shader, which is really actually pretty amazing.
That is really cool. And I think that, well, let me ask you this, because the Ale surface shader is actually kind of an Uber shader, right?
Yes.
But the most popular thing about it is the way that it does skin, which is extremely specific, right?
Yep. We'll probably eventually get around to doing all the other parameters of the shader.
Right.
Like refractions and thin backside scattering. But right now for skin materials, it's really, really useful and people like it a lot.
Well, what I also liked about it is I was, you know, as I was looking at it, how it does the actual skin and going back to the WikiHuman project and seeing how we tried to do that, all of the philosophies of what we did for Digital Emily were applicable to Ale surface shader. And I was able to use the same thing. In fact, it was much simpler because everything that we talked about in the WikiHuman was pretty much already built into the Ale surface shader.
You had all the slots.
Slots were there, right? The only thing that was a little bit confusing is how it assumes diffuse and subsurface balance.
There's a mix amount.
Right.
Parameter,
but you're using the same texture.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that was different. In V-Ray, you would have one texture for diffuse and then you have the subsurface. Here you use the same texture for both.
Yep.
And then it's just which ones, how much of it is actually subsurface and how much of it is.
Some users didn't actually like the fact that the two are linked in this way, but we've just kept things as they are in the original shader.
Right. And I like it. And translating Emily over to AL Surface was pretty good. It looked very similar to what we had done for WikiHuman. The only big difference is on close-up stuff like nose and things of that nature, where we saw sort of a better shadow of some kind or less.
And you have some examples up on the blog, right, that you rendered out?
Yep. You can go to the wikihuman.org for that to see some of those. And I also put it, obviously, I wrote a blog post about the AL Surface Shader. Anders is a very nice guy, and he's definitely very generous in giving shaders to everyone. But I really liked the approach that it worked. And it was kind of nice to say, well, you just out of the box, the WikiHuman data looks good. So, and since that is an open source shader, people are familiar with it, and it sort of opens it up for everyone to use it.
Do you think people see Emily on the street and go like, hey, there's digital Emily?
I don't know.
In real life.
I don't know. She's really nice. But obviously, we've been starting to work with a new data set. The reason being that it is challenging. Emily's acting career has taken off. She's doing a lot of fun stuff. So I think her agent says, you know, they can't sort of use your likeness for free forever. We still use the data set we have, and we still have the right to do that, but we can't continue to ask her. It's like, hey, can you come in? We want to scan your cheekbone again or something like that. But so we're starting to use Mike now for all that stuff. And Mike is generously donated his time to get himself poked and probed and
scanned
in all corners of the globe, because he's been to Zurich and he's been to LA and all kinds of stuff. So there's a lot of fun stuff going on there. Okay, let's see. What else do we have covered? Okay. Oh, right. And coming up at the end of this month, Lon, is going to be another release. This seems to be releasing stuff all the time.
Got a lot of stuff coming out. A lot of good stuff.
But V-Ray for Nuke.
Yeah.
So V-Ray for Nuke is interesting. A lot of people are starting to look into it a lot more with a lot more intent. And one of the big things that we're releasing for free, right, is the denoiser node.
Yep.
So explain that, what that means.
One of the biggest features of V-Ray 3.4 that we released last year was the denoiser.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen more and more people trying to work with it.
Yep.
And it turned out that it's really useful for animations, because it can help stabilize animations even at extreme noise levels.
Right.
Which is really surprising, but it works. And we thought that for various reasons, like sometimes doing the denoising inside the render is not really either applicable or not desirable. Because you might want to have additional control, or for example, you might want to do some deep compositing with the images and then denoise the result afterwards. And we couldn't really figure out, especially with the deep images, there's no real way to denoise them in the render itself.
Okay.
So it always has to come as a post-process once all the compositing is done and the deep images flatten to a regular image.
Right.
And then you can do the denoising. So that's why having a denoising node in Nuke seemed such a good idea and a good fit. Besides, you can also use, like, the denoiser uses a render element called noise level.
Okay.
Which determines which part of the image are noisy and require more work, mm-hmm. and which parts are clean. And you can actually use this render element as a mask or a guide for the denoiser. So if you want to denoise just some part of the image, you can mask it in this render element and pass it on to the denoiser.
Interesting.
So it gives you a lot more control
over
the process.
So now one of the render elements is, where is it noisy?
Yes. Yes.
And so but this is a node now in Nuke, right? So does it work with V-Ray renders, obviously?
Well, yeah, it works with V-Ray renders, but it's also a very generic node. Like, it can work with things coming out from any renderer.
Oh, okay.
You might need to dial in some parameters manually. Like, if there's no noise level render element, then you will have to tell the denoiser what the noise level is by putting a number. But other than that, it just uses regular output from that renderers usually provide, like diffuse surface color, global illumination, normals, world normals,
right.
World position, stuff like that. So it's not really designed to work only with V-Ray.
Right. But it's kind of nice because if people are doing their V-Ray renders.
Yeah, you get all
the compositor, you can just use this node. It's like, all right, I can just do a denoising on it as it's going on the fly.
Yep.
And we decided to give it out for free, which is kind of cool.
The denoising plugin itself, it's not a part of V-Ray. It's a separate thing that, I mean, obviously you get it with V-Ray for Nuke, but we also have a separate download that you can put inside of Nuke without the need to have V-Ray for Nuke at all.
Right. So that's kind of nice. Yeah, it's really cool. And have you noticed people starting to use it a lot more?
They're looking into it. It's on the forum, the feedback was very positive.
Good.
Some people said that it's just now a regular part of their pipeline.
Yeah.
So it's definitely useful.
Well, I was talking to Daniel Trubovich the other day, and he was showing me some big VR thing he was doing, and he does all the rendering in his house, and he's got a few computers. He says, I didn't have time for a lot of renders, so I basically just set everything to render for like 6 or 8 minutes a frame, and then denoised it. And I guess that's another good solution for that, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's good to have that option, so you can get a not so grainy image. And it's interesting because to be honest, I guess I'm a little bit of a purist, and I'm not necessarily a huge fan of the idea that you're denoising your image, but if it works for people's workflows, that's good for me.
Yeah, I mean, me too. Like, obviously, we've been moving away from gradients, caching, and so on, which are all interpolation methods. So going back to denoising is something like a little bit of a step back.
Right.
But if it helps in practice, then I'm all for it.
Yeah.
And then you end up denoising it and then putting film grain or something back on top of it. Like you know that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah. It's true. I guess some of the other stuff is there. We're doing a bunch of new updates or support for deep compositing in Nuke, right?
Yeah, actually, the two main new features in V-Ray for Nuke are first the volume grid, which allows you now to open VDB caches and render them with V-Ray. So they can come from Houdini or Phoenix or other simulators. That's really useful. And along with that, you can also output directly deep images from V-Ray for Nuke.
Right.
And you can do deep compositing right inside of Nuke without having to go through a deep file and so on.
Which, let me just tell you, someone who's worked in VFX a little bit and hung out with a bunch of Houdini guys and compositing guys. So you never really know how the smoke or the explosion or whatever needs to be lit. You don't really know. A lot of cases. So what a lot of the guys would do is they would do, you know, what's called RGB lighting, right? So they'd have three different light directions that they would light the smoke with, and they would light it one with a green light, one with a blue light, one with a red light, and then the compositor would bring that in and basically dial in colors to the smoke based on that RGB light, which worked, but really it's only three choices and you don't really know how big the light is or whatever, and it's just kind of like it worked. Now the effects guy can basically say, I'll just do the sim for you, and I won't even render it. I'll just give you the VDB file, and the compositor can light it exactly, composite it into the scene perfectly, and has control of the lighting of the smoke, right?
You can even use the exact same, like if you render with V-Ray, obviously you can export the lighting in a V-Ray scene file, and then you can use the exact same lighting setup inside of V-Ray for
Nuke. Oh, right, right. Oh, even better. Right. So so let's say you have the lighters have made some exploding tank or something like that. That's all run without smoke. And then the Houdini guys did the smoke. They can just bring the smoke, and then the lighters can give them the exact lights that were used in the in the tank, and they could light it exactly the same.
Yep.
Yeah. Brilliant. And then you render it all out together, anti-aliasing matches, all that stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or if you want to do, like, you can still render the smoke separately and do deep compositing if you want. For whatever reasons.
Right. But yeah, that's it's a big deal. Big deal. Volume Grid is a big deal. I'm really curious to see people using Volume Grid directly in Nuke. And we render it pretty fast. Like Volume Grids actually render fairly fast in
yeah. Yeah. It's not too bad.
Yeah. Which is really cool. But how does V-Ray render in Nuke? Because when I see the videos, I just want people, I kind of know, but I'm used to seeing, you know, buckets and progressive rendering. But it, right. when I look at it in Nuke, it looks like it's scanlining, but it's not really, right?
It actually is scanlining. It was a very complicated issue for us because if you want to use Nuke nodes directly as part of the rendering, like if you want to use some kind of Nuke network mm-hmm. as a texture, mm-hmm. then V-Ray needs to be able to call Nuke to evaluate that shading network during the render.
Right.
And to do that, it needs to be done from a rendering thread that Nuke itself creates. So we can't make the rendering completely outside of the normal Nuke pipeline.
Okay.
And it caused us, well, not a terrible amount of headaches, but it was fairly difficult to pull it off because we had to make sure that that we use the threads that are created by Nuke and not our own V-Ray threads.
Right.
But anyway, the V-Ray architecture was luckily flexible enough to allow us to do that without breaking everything.
Right. But that's cool. And I know I've actually gotten some emails from some people recently. They were like, I really want to, I've got some ideas now of some big stuff because Nuke can do a lot more now than it ever has. So, mm-hmm. and they want to do it. They want to use V-Ray inside of Nuke. So it's cool to see that. Other things that we've supported is we're doing things like triplanar mapping, which is kind of a nice way to sort of wrap things.
I think that's a perfect sort of texturing workaround for Nuke, right? Because you don't want to spend all this time with UVs. Normally, like in composite, you're like, I just need a little dirt or I need a little rust or something.
Right. On. Yeah. So triplanar is great.
Makes it easy.
Makes it definitely easier. And then we support the light cache now. So explain that process.
So the light cache, yeah. Originally, when we released V-Ray for Nuke, we only had brute force as the method for computing global illumination. Mm-hmm. And again, this was because of the whole Nuke pipeline where we couldn't do a pre-pass mm-hmm. on the scene. But now with the adaptive lights, which for the CPU version of V-Ray, they rely on the light cache. Mm-hmm. So we had to figure out a way to get this inside of Nuke. Okay. So you don't see the calculation phase of the light cache. Mm-hmm. So it's not like 3ds Max or Maya where you can see it because mm-hmm. it's being calculated. But it's still done and you can still use it in the final rendering and it helps a lot.
Okay.
For GI, obviously, the light cache can do multiple light bounces very efficiently.
Yep.
And also for the adaptive lights, which additionally speed up the render.
So adaptive lights is going to be in V-Ray for Nuke and all of those
oh,
things.
Yeah.
And does V-Ray for, I don't even know because I haven't used it, but does V-Ray for Nuke support GPU rendering as well?
Not inside of Nuke.
Okay.
But you can export a V-Ray scene file and you can render it with V-Ray standalone on the GPU if you want to.
Ah, okay. That's a good workaround. Okay, and then other things. Obviously, we're doing the Clipper plane. Why is the Clipper plane so popular? I mean, I know as an architect, it's like, yeah, that's useful. I remember trying to do stuff like that. But why? What's made it so popular?
It's a difficult. I don't know. Just obviously, for some reason, it's a situation that comes up often.
Yeah,
and it's just people find it useful.
And it can. It's not just a plane anymore. You can. Kind of arbitrarily make shapes, right?
You can pick any. Well, we had this in V-Ray 3.4, I think, where mm-hmm. you can use an arbitrary mesh to do the clipping. Mm-hmm. And
it's basically a fancy boolean.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a render time boolean.
It's a render time boolean. Yeah,
right.
It's not like because all the geometry is still there and V-Ray still has to consider it. It's not as fast as doing the actual boolean beforehand on the meshes. But on the other hand, if you have something like a full building model with hundreds of thousands of parts, you can't really boolean that.
Right.
So having the Clipper is really helpful.
Yeah, it's good. That's good. Well, we're pretty close to an hour, and we've covered almost all the things I want to talk about. Is there anything else you want to tell people about? Things to be excited about?
Well, Fury 3.5 is out now. We'll need to do a patch release at some point, as usual.
Yeah.
Things never go right the first time. But after that, it's Fury 3.6, and we have some cool things coming in that as well. Fury for Maya is obviously coming as well. Fury 3.5 for Maya, which has, other than the normal things that we have in Fury for Max, there are Maya-specific things like support for the new Maya Grimwald splines, the new render layer system in Maya. So yeah, pretty exciting stuff for Maya users as well.
Did we talk about the IPR in Max, the interactive production render?
Oh yeah,
we forgot about that.
Well, let's go back. IPR.
Because I was thinking, like, that's a big one. Like,
we spend so much time on the GPU, but we've actually done stuff with the CPU render as well. So, and that Lon mentioned this a little bit, where people thought that the GPU render is only for previews, where the regular viewer is just for production rendering.
Right.
But now we've made it possible for users to use the production V-Ray render in an interactive mode. So it will just keep track of the changes that you're doing to the scene and update the image. Obviously, the progressive sampler and progressive rendering helps a lot in that.
Sure, but you could technically be in bucket mode and it'll continuously update.
Yeah, it probably makes a little bit less sense to work this way,
but it's enough that it, like, it works. Now, the way that it works is not the same as like active the active shade, right?
Yeah, it's different.
No, it's part of the frame buffer. Yeah,
for the, well, it's the button is in the frame buffer.
Right, the button is in the frame buffer. So you may notice a new button in your frame buffer.
Yeah, and the thing is that in order to get the interactive rendering working, we had to do quite a lot of changes to V-Ray itself, because some of that code was really old, like 15 years old.
Right.
And it wasn't really designed from the beginning for interactive work. So just reshuffling everything and making sure that things update properly as people change things in the scene, materials, lights, geometry. It was a little bit complicated. We still have a little bit more work to do on that because there was just not time to finish everything. But even right now, it's useful because it just gives you the exact same result as your final render, and you can make a lot more accurate decisions about materials and lighting and so on.
Right.
And I think that's how people are used to working nowadays too, right? Like, there's, you're just leaving it render and you're just constantly iterating and adjusting on the fly. So
And also related to that is...
There's no more time to get up and get a coffee.
So this is in Max. In Maya, the IPR rendering was actually always like that. It matched the production rendering perfectly because it was the same render in Maya.
Right.
Max was the only odd one out, actually. Right. Because Vue is so much more integrated with the Max rendering, because Max has a rendering API in the first place. But in Maya, we never had the problem of matching stuff with the IPR, but we did have a problem with doing the IPR in a separate Vue standalone process. So for the 3.5 release in Maya, we are doing the actual rendering inside Maya itself. So that first it starts to render a lot faster when you press the IPR button, and then it reacts to scene changes a lot faster because there's no need to transfer stuff to another process. And it's way more responsive than it was before.
That's interesting. That's really cool. And
also, it can reuse, if textures have already been loaded, it will just reuse them. So there's no need to wait for textures to load like we had to do before. So
okay.
It's way more useful now.
Well, that's good. And then we also have, what was the other thing, Lon? V-Ray for SketchUp and Rhino and stuff, those are coming out.
Coming soon.
Very soon.
Phoenix for Maya coming soon.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there's a lot of stuff. We'll obviously be announcing them as we go along.
It's going to be a busy couple of months.
Yeah. You are going to be at some good key events this year that we're excited to see. So if you want to see Vlado or hear about what's going on, you're going to be at EUE, right?
I am going to be at the end user event.
Yeah.
And also for the first time, I'm going to be at FMX.
Yeah. So you're going to be at FMX, which we're excited. I'm obviously going to be at FMX as well. So it's going to be really cool to have Lotto there. I think they've got a good FMX is going to be really cool this year. I'm excited about it. Very excited. That's coming up actually faster than that probably want to happen. Yep. But that's great. All right. Is there anything else we want to talk about? I don't think so. It's good to have Lotto back here. He's been hanging out with us.
Got to return the tux.
Yeah.
Yep. Got to take the tux back.
Yep. Yep. So we'll do that today.
Until the next time.
Will there be a next time?
You never know, Lotto. You never know. We'll make occasions for you. All right, guys. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.